Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
They say plants like music.
Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to With Friends Like These, a podcast about difficult conversations. And you know what? This week's conversation is actually a little bit more difficult for me than last week's, even though my guest, Ira Madison, is someone who I probably agree with on almost any policy you could name. But ideological and policy differences are not the only differences we have in this society, and sometimes they're not even the most important differences. And sometimes the differences we don't talk about with our friends are the ones that deserve the most attention. So Ira was good enough to sit down with me for a little while and bear with my massive discomfort about some of this stuff. And I hope you appreciate his patience as much as I did. That conversation coming right up. So, welcome Ira Madison III.
Thank you for having me.
At Ira on Twitter. We were just talking about how lucky you are. Or not lucky. It was a business negotiation for you to get at Ira.
It was.
Okay. You're a culture writer at MTV News, and you write a lot about movies.
I do.
And you've been following specifically, this has been the year of Moonlight.
It has been.
What's your take on what happened at the Oscars? Because I'll tell you, watching it, it felt metaphorical, but I'm not sure what the metaphor was.
Yeah. What's funny is that I feel like everyone wants to ascribe the election to everything.
Right.
Beyonce losing at the Grammys, the Falcons losing the Super Bowl, when La La Land seemed like it won.
Right.
The internet, again, was all like, oh.
If only this could have happened at the election.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I don't know, people relate the election to when Starbucks gives them the wrong order these days. But I think that, for me, metaphorically, it was just a reminder of how Black people constantly have to share the space in America. You know, there's never really our specific lane. And even when there is, you know, it's always, why don't they have white people on BET? You know, like that's always a claim that some Twitter egg will slide into your mentions and ask, like, during the BET like music awards or something. Mm-hmm. And it's Justin Timberlake has a mountain of them. Sam Smith has one. You know, it's we give awards to more white people at our Black awards than white award shows have historically given to Black people.
Right. Why are there historically Black colleges, Ira?
You know, because of school choice.
I always have felt like we could just call, like, Harvard and Yale historically white colleges, right?
We should.
Like, that's the case.
Yeah.
And, you know, this the way that Moonlight, you know, had to share the stage literally is now being extended into the aftermath of the Oscars. We were just talking about the cover of Variety.
Yes. So the cover of Variety has Damien Chazelle, the director of La La Land, on it, which, of course, historically, Variety does a cover with the winner of Best Director. They've had Alfonso Cuarón on it. Inarritu was on the cover. When Inarritu won back-to-back, last year they had the cinematographer for The Revenant
on the cover.
So they bent the rules last year. And all I was suggesting online is that if we've bent the rules once, why not bend the rules again? You know, if it was such a historic moment on Sunday, not only because Moonlight was the first LGBT picture to win Best Picture, not only because it was the second black film to win Best Picture, and the first one was a slave film, the first American black director, because Steve McQueen is British, and the fact that, you know, La La Land was read as the winner at first, and then Moonlight was pulled on stage when they realized that there was an error. I just think that nothing has been precedented about the ceremony. So I just think that why continue to go with precedent and why not just, you know, break free? Barry Jenkins did reach out to me on Twitter and tell me that he was a guest on the cover. You know, it was Chazelle's cover and Chazelle invited him to be on the cover. But it's unfortunate that two people who are very friendly with each other and love each other's work have to be embroiled in this larger conversation about race in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But it's one that we need to have, if only because when you Googled Moonlight yesterday, you rarely saw any headlines with mentioning Moonlight's win, mentioning its historic win, and any photos with the cast. They were all the La La Land cast.
The import of it being the film that it was, yeah, which is not just a black film, but a gay black film.
Like, that's really, really fucking important, you know? Like,
we got to completely skip over the conversation about black male gay sexuality.
Yeah.
And just talk about, ooh, tie.
Especially especially since whenever we talk about, you know, black male sexuality, there's always, you know, that thing about how, like, black people are, quote unquote, more homophobic than white people. Like, that's always a conversation that's brought up. And there's just no discussion about this sort of film, how important it is. And all the headlines were about Jordan Horowitz, the producer who, you know, quickly took the card from Warren Beatty and was like, oh no, this is Moonlight's moment, which is great. And, you know, in contrast with Berger, the other producer who decided to read his speech, even though he knew that they had lost, it looks like a great thing to do.
Right.
But also, you know, what's the alternative? It's live TV. They weren't going to, you know, scam their way into winning it. They weren't going to be able to take the Oscar and run. You know, it's just sort of, there's a lot of writing and, like, ballyhoo over doing something that you sort of had to do. It's like, I'm gracious giving my seat on a flight to someone when I realize that I'm sitting in the wrong seat. But I could have kept it.
Yeah, someone told me a story once about how her father or uncle, during segregation, during Jim Crow era, once gave up his seat for a black woman. And she told me this story with some pride. And I'm like, wow, that's the literal least you can do.
did he sit in? Did he go to a sit-in? He gave his seat to a black woman. I'm sure she got hit by a police officer and told to move right afterwards.
You know, I mean, so one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is that I wanted to talk about friendships between black people and white people. Mm-hmm. And the sort of irony of it is that
I have a lot of white friends.
Good. Maybe you can tell me about white people. Maybe actually that's what I should be asking about. It's not you tell me about what black people think, but tell me about what white people think. Because I know that one of the problems with being kind of the black friend is that you get turned to as kind of like
a confidant. The
confessor.
Yeah. The black friend on TV is
So there's a stereotype about the black friend who's like always gets killed first in the horror movie.
Yeah.
Always like gets this sort of like the confessor of the hero. And
yeah.
Then
the white woman tells her black friend
black friend
tells her about her love woes, and then the black friend's like, "Go and get that man, girl."
Always with the sassiness. But you're saying, when I told you I wanted to talk about that, you were like, "Which do you want to talk about?" But the stereotype is kind of. White people take that stereotype into their lives.
True. There's so many instances of it. You know, speaking about the segregation thing, you know, like how much did white people afford Bernie Sanders during his campaign with, you know, he marched with Martin Luther King. Mm. He was right there in the civil rights movement. It's like, okay. You know, it's like people think that doing something like that or voting for Obama gives you like a free race pass and you never have to engage with anything that's current going on anymore. And it's sort of people, I feel like, take one interaction with a black person or maybe the one black person in their life as sort of a way to help them deal with racism in a way that is often taxing to black people, you know?
I was going to say they help them deal with racism. It's more that they use it as a badge of like, I can't be racist.
Yeah.
I have this black friend.
Yeah.
And so what does that feel like though on the side of the, I mean, I feel weird asking you because like, hey, black person, tell me what it feels like to be a black person. But I want to ask you about your experience.
You're doing it too.
I know. No. I'm doing it too. But your personal experience with this, what's that like?
Let's say like after the election, you know, I woke up to a barrage of text messages with just like, wow, how do I process this? Or I'm so sorry about what happened. From some people like who aren't even very close friends of mine. And it was just, why do I have to help you process this? You know, it's like it's that Chris Rock joke that he did on SNL. Like black people were already sort of prepared to lose. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when Hillary lost, it was white people reaching out to black people and being like, oh, we're sorry. We had no idea that there was still so much racism in this country. And
they wouldn't have done that, obviously, if Hillary had lost. But the amount of racism in the country would have been the same.
Right. If Hillary had won.
Or Hillary had won, the amount of racism in the country would have been the same.
Yeah. The funny thing is, if Hillary had won, we wouldn't be having these conversations. Yeah. There'd still be the same amount of racist people. We'd just be moving on, you know? And it gets exhausting, you know? And it's never people, like I said, I actually do have like an abundance of white friends being from
Milwaukee.
I don't want
you to throw anyone under the bus, exactly.
Throw all of them under the bus. No, but it's, I have... Not even, I have friends who obviously are better than they would actually say out loud, excuse me, I have a black friend. So that's what I know. But it manifests itself in different ways, you know? I think that, you know, people may try and speak with an authority on race issues just because they've heard one person say something. I mean, it's the way that racist or white conservatives will often say, reference their black friend, but their black friend is Ben
Carter.
Carson.
Ben Carson, yeah. Everybody, that one black friend of theirs.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, which black friend is it? When you have one black person to rely on, chances are you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Because if there was a white person who just only listened to me, I don't know everything.
I was going to say, like, what if you only had one white friend?
Yeah.
Like, and you just processed everything through that one white friend. I mean, no one expects the opposite, right?
Right. I have my best friend loves Madonna and wrestling and If I only processed white people through that one person, I would think that all white people love Madonna and the WWE.
Right. Which, to be fair, those are both very popular things with white people. They really are. Well, I'm curious, again, I don't want to treat you like as a representative of like black culture, because that's what we're talking about. Like, mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I do think it's valuable for like good white liberals, people who think of themselves as good white liberals, to understand that their view of the world, if it's shaped by this narrow personal relationships, mm-hmm. I mean, that matters.
Yeah. And it's this narrow idea of sort of expecting things from black people too. I don't know if this is the black friend trope, but it's because you have sort of a relationship with this black person and you know that they maneuver their way through life and understand race in a different lens than you do. Often we're tasked with doing free labor for white people. Let me give you an example.
Doing free labor for white people. But you mean emotional labor?
Let me give you a non-cotton example. I am a culture writer.
Right.
I've written about Moonlight,
which we started the conversation about.
Yes. Right. I wrote a very long, very personal essay about Moonlight last year.
Which is excellent, and people should check it out.
Thank you.
MTV.com.
After Moonlight won, I was getting, you know, a few tweets from people being like, can't wait to hear Ira's take on Moonlight's win, et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, where's your piece on, like, Moonlight winning? You know, it's so historic. And, I, you know, I hosted a show for MTV on election night, so I said all I had to say about the Oscars.
And on the Oscar night.
And I have a piece about it already. You know, read that piece if you want to know what I think about Moonlight. And you can extrapolate how I feel about its win. You know, it's just the idea that because black people write about certain things that you're sort of expecting a response from them. Like, someone tagged me and Kara Brown from Jezebel in a tweet last week, was like, can't wait to hear what they think about Get Out, the new horror movie. It's like, because it's a black horror movie,
right.
It's like...
Which you do have opinions
about. I have opinions about it, obviously, but do you want to know what I think about this week's episode of Riverdale?
I personally do, because I care about your opinion. But this is like the problem. I mean, this is sort of when people adopt a Twitter black friend,
mm-hmm.
right?
Exactly. There's a lot of times when you're a black person on Twitter who expresses opinions about things or you write about things, you're constantly called upon by other people. You know, say, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Particularly, I have a podcast, Speed Dial, with Doreen St. Felix.
Which is excellent, and you should download it.
Doreen St. Felix is at MTV. She's a writer as well. She writes about music and culture. Oftentimes, she's written about social justice. She wrote when Philando Castile was killed. She wrote about... Diamond Reynolds, but often she's asked, what do you think about this dead black person this week, you know? Or like, what do you think of this social issue? Or we really need to get your opinion on this. And that can come from editors. It can come from fans online. Not even just the editors you work with. It can come from, you know, when white editors at other outlets are looking for freelance people, it's always, let me get a black person on the mic, you know, mm-hmm. to see what they have to say. It's why you always end up with, like, I don't know, some shitty take about Beyonce whenever she does anything. It's like, oh, we got to find some black person to write something about it, you know?
Right.
And then what if the black person writes something awful?
Right.
You know?
I'm talking to Ira Madison III. Who is a culture writer at MTV. Mm-hmm. We're having an awkward conversation, or I'm having an awkward conversation with Ira Madison. I don't know how awkward it is for you.
I know you. Right. So it's less awkward than if I were having it with random person on the street.
Right.
Yeah. Which does happen.
It does?
I left, we talked about Get Out. I left a screening of Get Out on Saturday with a couple friends, and this older white couple turned around and asked us, so what did you think of that movie, huh? Like, it was, and I think it's because it's a comedy, too, you know, like a horror comedy. They're comfortable asking you that, because, like, nobody asked me what I thought after 12 Years a Slave.
Well, I'm just thinking, would they have turned around and asked you what you thought about La La Land?
Yeah.
You know, because you're not being looked at as an authority. You happen to be an authority on movies and pop culture.
Yeah.
But that's not the lens that these strangers were looking at you through. They were thinking, here is a black person. Black person, how can I have your opinion? So we were just talking about the problem of when you have a narrow range of friends and you keep turning to the same people or same authors or same Twitter friends over and over, the same, because you feel like, I want to get an opinion of a black person. Mm-hmm. And just this very narrow range of people or one person starts to stand in for a whole bunch of people.
Yes.
Right. So, all right, I'll go with the uncomfortable conversation on my side first, which is I've shared with you, but it's weird to talk about. Which is that a couple of years ago, it was actually right around the time of the riots in Ferguson. Like, I looked around my social media feed and my social life and realized I didn't have very many, not just black friends, I just didn't have very many friends of color. Mm-hmm. And I decided I was going to do something about that, which is a weird thing to say and maybe a weird thing to think. Mm-hmm. But I was like, surely, how else is it going to happen?
Got to go to a rap concert.
Well,
I'm kidding. It's mostly white people at this.
I was going to say, like, and also, like, the kind of rap music I like is like the kind of rap music that white people like. So, I mean, I love Beyonce, right? So for me, I mean, I'm privileged in many ways. And one of the ways, though, is also that I'm a journalist and there are a lot of talented people of color in journalism world. Mm-hmm. And it was really, once I kind of thought of it, it was kind of easy to be like, oh, wait, that person wrote a piece I really like. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just going to tell them I liked that piece, even if it wasn't, and maybe this was the trick, even if it wasn't about race.
Especially if it's not about race.
And actually, now that I think about it, that wasn't actually conscious. Like, I was just on the prowl for, like, writing people who are writing really smart, interesting things. Mm-hmm. And in the back of my mind, maybe I did have a good instinct to not do it about personal essays and not do it about like pieces that are examining race from a personal perspective, but rather just like Jamil Bowie at Slate, like amazing political reporting, right? Joel Anderson at BuzzFeed, also a great reporter, also went to TCU, which was like, we had to be friends.
Joel's great.
Yeah, Joel's awesome. And then, you know, I wasn't like also, I don't think I did a thing where I was like, and I wanted to be friends and hang out. It was more like, I'm going to tell them they admire their work and like, I'm shrugging my shoulders.
If I just happen to be at this location.
Maybe go out for, because people, you know, grab drinks together all the time.
Yeah.
I didn't try to force anything, but I did just sort of make this effort to be like, I'm going to be aware of the people I'm reaching out to. And this is the part where the story gets more and more uncomfortable because I don't want to use the phrase it worked because that makes it sound like there was like an achievement and I get my white person merit badge, which I would like to get from you because you're the representative of black people. So give me my white person merit badge.
It's very hard to get those badges.
I know. Unlock. I do actually.
It's harder than Girl Scout badges.
I do feel like I could create a video game based on this, though. There would be certain achievements you could unlock and like there would be like having more than one black friend.
Yeah.
Having more than two, being able to make a joke about race with a black friend. That's like super.
That is top tier.
I actually like, I think you can adjust this. We share on Slack and you've probably seen this happen. Like I'll make a joke about race and be like, is that okay? Is that all right? Everybody okay? Is that all right? But you know, again, I don't want to say like, and then the achievement's unlocked, but I have found that it's not that fucking hard. And my life has changed a little bit, you know? It's weird for me to speak about it because again, I don't want to think of it as something to achieve and I don't want to pat myself on the back. But I did take the risk of telling you this story and once a few months ago. And your reaction, though, made me feel a lot less weird or better, at least, because you were just like, oh, thank God. Thank you for having more than one black friend.
It is nice when you realize that someone has, you know, more than one. And it's...
And is it always obvious? Is it like kind of obvious when people have more than one black
friend? It can kind of be obvious because they'll always like reference what such and such says.
The other black friend.
And they just always like have the same sort of slanted viewpoint on race. I mean, the movie Dear White People opens with like, Tessa, the actress, saying, you know, it's gone up. You now need more than one black friend to, you know, be down, and your drug dealer doesn't count.
Right. I have a lot less black friends now that I don't do as many drugs, but or fewer black people in my life. No, that's a lie. That's a joke. But I actually so curious. Like, let's get to the uncomfortable part of this. What does it feel like to have that be something that, like, I'm at least aware of?
Mm-hmm. I think people should be aware of it. I think the problem actually is when people either when they feel too comfortable, you know? I think there should always be a degree of discomfort just because we're talking about uncomfortable things, you know? Black people's lives aren't comfortable. So why should white people who want to know more about black people and, you know, what they're going through in their daily lives, why should that process be comfortable for them? This isn't an exact example, but, you know, I am not transgender. I don't. It's a
revelation.
Rubbing
eyes. What?
But I don't. I did not know that much about transgender men and women a few years ago. It's through following trans people online, you know, becoming friends with them, reading their work. Mm-hmm. You know, I particularly love Janet Mock, Raquel mm-hmm. Willis online.
Parker Malloy.
Parker Malloy. I love Parker Malloy. Kat Black. And a lot of it actually is you just want to be, you want to learn more so that you can educate yourself. Because I feel like if you get to a point, the problem when you know someone has just like the one black friend is when they feel too content, like they know everything. You know, it's like, I don't even know everything about white people. You know, I've seen Spin City, but
but you know me, so you could I'm pretty representative of white people.
But you know, some white people will be like, oh, I have this black friend, or I grew up with this black friend. Like, I get it all, you know, but you don't get it all. Just how by interacting with these great people online, I don't know all there is
About
the transgender experience, and which is why I continue to read more. I listen when they say something. But I also treat them as friends and colleagues online. To feel proud of myself, but I'm proud, you know, when I follow someone because I love their work, and then you find out mm-hmm. that they're transgender. Because
like, oh,
I don't feel
cool.
like I am searching it out right. and trying to be like, you know, I need to collect people. But
except there's
should.
A balance, right?
Yeah.
Because like I do think the intentionality is it's not going to happen otherwise,
yeah.
probably, right? Like if you want to expand the number of people in your life who are different than mm-hmm. you, because we live in a world that's so siloed, mm-hmm. unless you make that effort, mm-hmm. it's going to feel uncomfortable. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And that effort is going to feel uncomfortable. And you just made me realize, like, that is, like, the number one white fear.
Mm-hmm.
Like, white people.
That you will be uncomfortable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Discomfort. And from what I can tell, like, the movie Get Out has something to do
yes.
with that. Like, the white horror movie
mm-hmm.
is awkward silence.
Yeah.
And or awkwardness of any kind. And I think you just pointed out something that really turns it around for me, which is that like the lives of people who are in vulnerable communities or positions are always uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like the social awkwardness that a white person might feel, like stepping out of their comfort zone to like hang out with someone different, mm-hmm. is like, again, literally the least you could do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, actually, it's not the least. It's something. It's yeah. worth doing.
Yeah. It's that, it's honestly, if we didn't want white people to do the work, there wouldn't be articles and things like, more books to read that help you with intersectional feminism, you mm-hmm. know, more books to read to help you understand trans rights, you know, mm-hmm. It's education. I think that I just wish everyone in the world were slightly more curious mm-hmm. about the world around them, you know? I feel like it's less uncomfortable for me to learn about different cultures because I am genuinely interested.
Right.
You know? And I think part of the problem comes with some people who just really just don't want to know anything mm-hmm. about the rest of the world, but they sort of feel obligated to, so they don't come off as racist. And I think that's where, you know.
Right. And I think you can get through that discomfort, like the discomfort or awkwardness I feel just even telling you that story, and the discomfort and awkwardness I felt even being intentional. Like I was kind of able to, number one, realize I was being like that discomfort is a tool of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
If I just stay my life comfortable, then it's not going to happen. And number two, like I do think I can say like I was genuine in my curiosity and interest about other people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's sort of the thing that separates like when you get into the nitty gritty of those friendships. Or what can separate like just following someone online to something that might blossom into a friendship is when you have curiosity in someone's individual experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm interested in you, Ira.
Yeah.
like you.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I want to have black friends and that even saying it still seems weird.
Yeah.
But like I think you're interesting and cool, and I think you can that's a difference between how I relate to you and how someone maybe who's looking just to
exactly.
Claim the merit badge.
Yeah. And even people who aren't looking to claim a merit badge can accidentally, you know, seem like they are. But it's just like, just own up to, you know, like the thing I talked about, like someone tagging me and being like, can't wait to hear what Ira thinks about like this black thing.
Sorry.
You know, it's just be like, oh, you know what, like, you know, obviously you want to hear what I think because you like my other work. And this person, I'm not going to call them out because they actually interact with all of the things that mm-hmm. I write. But it's, you know, specifically being like, I want this from so-and-so, you know? And it's hard because we talk about we need more representation in the media. But it's also, I understand it's also hard to be a white editor and be like, well, I need to assign a freelance piece. Do I approach this? You know, I have a friend at a publication who was specifically reaching out to a black writer to write a piece about Get Out.
Right.
And I made a joke with him. I was like, I guess you have to find a black person to write about it. And it's, you know, part of it comes from, if your circle is big enough,
right,
then it doesn't feel like you're cherry picking.
Right.
You know, if you have more than one black person on your staff, like thankfully we do at MTV, we can write about different topics. You know, I don't have to write about politics because Jameel's there. You know, it's like, and in turn, Jameel doesn't have to write about
civil rights issues all the time. Jameel can write about anything he wants because he's covering politics.
Yes.
Right.
And it's just, you know, not feeling like you're placing your black friends or any people of color in your life into a certain beat,
mm-hmm.
you know? One thing I actually will say that I was thinking about, too, about books to read and mm-hmm. culture, branch out more into like current, you know, black writers too, you know? I just always find someone online being like read James Baldwin and Audre Lorde and, you know, Maya Angelou.
People and who are like, talking about the last civil rights struggle.
Yeah, like, right? Read Claudia Rankine, you know? Read Margot Jefferson. Read Hinton Ault. It's like, read new writers. Mm-hmm. Look at new books that are coming out. Patrick Beatty, Patrick Cooper.
Yeah.
He wrote this book, The Sellout.
Paul Beatty.
Yeah. Wrote The Sellout, which was great. Right. I read it on vacation. And it's, you know, it's like, seek out new voices. Mm-hmm. Because if you're continually trying to educate yourself on a culture with pieces that were published like 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
Like, James Baldwin's great, but he wasn't writing about what's going on in culture right now.
Right.
So find those voices.
All right. I've been talking to Ira Madison, and it's not as awkward as it could be, but I'm pleased with how awkward it is. You are listening to With Friends Like These. So we were just talking about the awkwardness of that white people might feel in reaching out beyond their comfort zone. And I think you made an important point about, you know, what happens when maybe there's a slight misstep, which is to say, like, you find yourself as a white person, like, being like, I wonder what black person thinks about black thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, because that's the problem.
Yeah.
And I think you sort of touched on this, but I want to make sure I'm getting it right, which is that it's OK if that happens. Because you can then be like, oh, I just did this thing that is a little, you know, stereotyping or cherry picking, right?
Learn you did something dumb, you know? Like, yeah. That's what education is all about,
right.
You know? Like, I think people always feel like they have to get it right all mm-hmm. the time, you know? And if education in these matters is just like education in school... I didn't know what fractions were, you know, when I was a kid. I didn't know Pythagorean theorem. Like, I didn't know this shit. So it's like you have to learn and fail.
Right.
So you have to fail to learn anything, you
right.
know? And so you're not going to come out of the gate being the perfect ally.
Right. And so people are so, because it is true in like, you know, good, among good American liberals, being called a racist is like the worst thing you could be called.
Exactly. And it's become,
right.
I don't know. It's become like,
so no one ever says it anymore, yeah. Which means we don't get to talk about it, which is, I want to get to that. But mm-hmm. like, what I think that can mean is that people are so afraid of being seen as racist or being doing something even slightly racist, they just don't do anything, right? Or only do stuff that's within this certain prescribed set of behaviors.
Right.
When really, like, we also all do racist things all the time. And it's better, at least if you know that. Like, go ahead and say the thing that you're curious about.
Mm-hmm.
Ask the question that you're curious about. And maybe it doesn't go great. You know,
mm-hmm.
Like we have a mutual friend who told me the story, which was about he was like watching football at a friend's house on, you know, whatever, like a year ago. And during halftime, this friend turned to him and was like, so Trayvon Martin, this police brutality thing or like this, you know, violence against black people. That's really, gosh, you know, terrible. And our poor friend is like, I want to watch the game.
Being caught off guard is the worst. It's like, I want people to take their own experiences and, like, you know, realize how other people might feel when you say things like that. You know,
yeah.
like if
for women, if like we're watching a football game and like a guy turns to me and goes, so rape. God, that sucks. It sucks to get raped, doesn't it?
What are we going to do about that?
But I want to point out, but this friend of mine, I think, had the presence of mind to be like, it's awkward and it's silly and we can mock it.
Mm-hmm.
But like asking is better than not asking.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, having made that mistake and getting maybe some pushback from the person saying, I don't want to talk about it right now, and also don't look at me as a single representative, you might get told that.
Yeah. I do that with my friends many times. Like, I've told a friend or two, especially during this, like, hotbed of a...
Hot mess of like a culture.
This exploding volcano that was 2016.
Shit geyser, as I like to call it. Yeah.
When they said something, you know, it was like, we're not going to talk about that now, but we can have that conversation at a later date. Or, you know, it's... Or like, go read this.
Yeah. I mean, although still, like, it's the like emotional and intellectual work of like the minority person to have at the ready, yeah, like a list of things to hear. Go read this.
Yeah.
You know, women, I think women feel a little bit of that because mm-hmm. there is something akin to like, so rape. God, that sucks.
Yeah. You know,
like, that happens for women.
Yeah.
And it's work that you can choose, but it's work that you can choose to do or not to do. Mm-hmm. And it has to be okay to not do it as well. It
yeah.
has to be okay if your black friend or your female friend or your transgender friend doesn't like want to bone up on this stuff for you. Like, that has to be okay.
Yeah.
Like, there has to be value to that friendship beyond just
because the internet exists.
Yeah.
You know, follow a bunch of people and learn something, you know?
Let us switch a little bit to the shit geyser of 2016 and the aftermath, the continuing, flowing shit geyser.
It's still going.
It's still going. Again, there's the meta conversation of having to turn to you, but like, I'm curious, you, when you see the conversation happening among white liberals right now, like, mm-hmm. what's your reaction? When we went wringing our hands about the white working class, wringing our hands about if she'd had an economic policy or economic appeal closer to Bernie.
First of all, I like...
And the big question, which we'll get to in a second, are Trump voters racist?
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. let's go with a general overview and then let's get to that question.
First of all, I'm just like perfectly glad not to hear the name Hillary Clinton again. Like, ever. It's like, okay, sis, you lost the election. It's cool.
Yeah.
Start a foundation or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But like, live your life like Obama now. You know, like, go on a vacation. She's singing Broadway shows. You know, it's just like people keep bringing up, this is why Hillary lost. This is why Trump won. Identity politics, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, like we were saying earlier, you wouldn't be having these annoying conversations if Hillary had won. But now so many white people want to be an expert on how we stop racism in America. And the way that they've decided we stop it is by being extra nice to white people.
To other white people.
And right. Learning history in school, I never saw a single instance where... racism or civil rights were solved by being extra nice to white people, but maybe that's in Betsy DeVos's new curriculum.
Right. And what you're talking about specifically is this hand-wringing about the white working class,
Didn't even get him elected. It was...
Can I say preach, or is that cultural appropriation?
You've been to church before.
I'll say it like a white person.
Okay.
Preach. Tell me more about this.
You saying preach like that? That was perfect.
Okay.
It's an
they
ignorance.
They didn't get him elected.
Yeah, it's an ignorance of the fact of like who actually voted for Trump. You know?
Rich white people.
It's the
And who didn't vote for him?
It's the people at his fucking swamp amusement park, Mar-a-Lago, right now. Like, those kind of people with the money to spend on, you know, the racist equivalent of Soho House.
Right.
To just, like, hang out.
That is good.
Hang out with Trump and just, like, give him a thumbs up on the golf course. It's like those
weigh in on North Korea policy.
Right.
Yeah.
Those are the people who got him elected.
And to just point out what the counter argument that might be, yes, but rural white counties voted for Trump. But he wouldn't have won just with them. And also, there's the missing piece, which you can speak to especially, which is that had that 70,000, 80,000 votes turned out in places like Milwaukee, mm-hmm. or 40,000, I think it was in Milwaukee, if people of color had turned out in even close to the numbers mm-hmm. that they turned out for Obama, we would not be having this conversation.
And that's about organizing. That's not about whether or not, you know, Philip feels bad that you called him a racist.
Yeah.
That was the first white name I could think of.
It's a very
of.
White name.
Okay.
Evan.
Heath.
Gary. Let's just name some white names. Is that stereotyping? Well, and also, I mean, so I hate terms like silver lining. Mm-hmm. There are opportunities in the crisis we're having now. One of them is we are talking about white working class, the plight of the white working class, which there is a huge opioid epidemic happening that's decimating these communities, like literally decimating these communities, which black people are familiar with this phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know? like we having people taken out of their lives and having
drugs destroying a community. Never heard of that before.
All right. as someone I know put it, like what's happening for the rural white working class is what has happened to black communities, you know, for centuries.
Yeah.
They're looking at the same kinds of problems. They're looking at families that are not mm-hmm. nuclear families. They're looking at the kind of like grinding, how do I just get by, mm-hmm. you know, working class. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm glad we're talking about these communities and I think they deserve attention. I think the debate over whether or not they're racist is weird.
Yeah. I mean, the difference is that, you know, in the future, it'll be easier to make heroin legalized than it is pot legalized because black people don't benefit from heroin, really.
Although it was vilified. The reason heroin was such a toxic, I mean toxic as in like, oh, my God, I'm not going to touch that, is because it was associated with black people for a long time.
Yeah. And now it's.
Yeah.
Now it's the new white thing. It's
and you see
it's
this
Iggy Azalea.
And you see this weird thing happening. We're kind of going to get off topic, but it's maybe worth pointing out, which is that there are communities that are taking a compassionate look at addiction, and there are police, you know, changing policies about how they go about dealing with addicts, but it's happening in white communities.
Because they see white women addicted to,
you know,
heroin,
yeah.
which always comes back to white women because 53% of them voted for Trump. You know, it's America runs on Duncan and white women. it's hard. I don't want to call all Trump supporters racist. I do.
Okay, but you want to. Let's be clear. You want to call them that.
I really want to. But I think that the conversation we need to be having is, sure, maybe you're not throwing on a cloak and burning a cross, but we do need to have a conversation in this country about white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And we do need to have a conversation about how you can specifically not be racist, but you benefit from racism.
Right. And I do think we sort of touched on this, which is the idea that the word racist and the concept of racism has become such a terrible thing to call somebody that mm-hmm. we avoid doing it at all costs. And also we've associated it with the kind of virulent racism that unfortunately we are seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are the Klan literally supports Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, and he is benefiting from the kind of racism that is the, I don't want to call it comic book, but, you know, the villainy racism. Right. He's
yeah.
benefiting from that. That's happening.
Yeah.
But when we talk
and
about
David Duke, tweets like he's enjoying an episode of Scandal on Thursday night.
And then Trump is apparently like taking the ideas that, you know, I don't know if he's seeing David Duke tweets, but like ideas that David Duke is putting forward, you know, Grand Dragon and Ku Klux Klan
yeah.
are getting said in the White House.
Yeah.
So there is that kind of racism happening, but that's not the kind of racism that elected him exactly.
No. It's the soft racism. I'm not racist. I just like this thing, this policy that benefits me.
Right.
Ignoring the fact of whether or not it's racist. Back on, you know, we opened with making the joke about Betsy and her HBCU thing.
Right.
You know, it's, she called it school choice.
Right.
Ignoring the fact that HBCUs were created because Black people could not get into white colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Say you weren't a white person. Say you were a white person who didn't hate Black people. You were just trying to go to school and be educated. You were still benefiting from the racist structure that did not allow Black people to go to your college,
right,
whether or not you even thought about it, you know?
Which is why, I mean, this is going to be, people who listen to this podcast are going to have to get used to the term white supremacy, because that is so much more useful to talk about than racism, because mm-hmm. a lot of people, most people don't hold hate in their hearts. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not actively discriminating against people of color in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the phrase, make America great again, if that is a phrase you believe in,
mm-hmm.
you are supporting white supremacy. It's sort of like saying, if you support the idea of we need to go back to the 1950s or 1960s,
mm-hmm.
you're supporting an America that...
Jim Crow.
Yeah. You're supporting America that has no gay marriage, that in fact has, like, you know, gay people being beaten on a regular basis. That has,
yes.
So you're saying that...
Which is easier... For people to say, actually, it's easier for conservatives to say, we don't want that gay marriage.
It's
they have
true.
They have to come up with
they're okay with that.
They have to come up with funny, you know, like whimsical ways to be racist. You know, they have to say like
whimsical ways to be if I'm like, homophobic
instead of homophobic.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, oh, there's some American carnage going on in Chicago. It's like, what are you talking about, really? But with gay people, they can just be like, we don't want them married.
Yeah. So. Unfortunately, like, our conversation is going to have to draw to a close. I think it was sufficiently awkward. I'm very proud of how awkward it was. I think on the awkward meter. Awkward enough that I felt it.
Yeah.
But also, hopefully, you know, worthwhile. If you want to follow Ira on Twitter, he's at Ira.
Mm-hmm.
You should read his stuff on MTV News. And you know what? Maybe I'll have you back because you're my... Oh, wait, no. Sorry. You are a Black friend of mine. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Capella University is rethinking higher education. With their game-changing FlexPath format, you can earn your degree on your schedule, so you can fit education seamlessly into your life. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.